Hi, this is Allison Sheridan of the No Silica Cast podcast, hosted at podfeet.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever so slight Macintosh bias. Today is Sunday, January 22nd, 2012, and this is show number 349. So last week was fun, wasn't it? You woke up Monday morning all excited to hear the latest episode of the No Silica Cast, or like Timothy Gregoire, happy to have some company on his 1.5 hour commute. But then, what the heck? No Silica Cast? Has the Earth stopped spinning on its axis? Was she hit by a train? It couldn't possibly be late. It's never late. Well, you can thank Libsyn for that little interruption in service. I uploaded the show to Libsyn around 6 p.m. as usual, had a lovely dinner of filet mignon with a nice Merlot, and then sat down to finish up the website part of the work, and then I hit publish. The first thing Steve and I do is check iTunes to make sure it downloads properly, and that's the first chance I give Steve to check to make sure the audio is in good shape. Well, imagine our dismay when we hit refresh, the little spinny thing started to spin, and then it stopped. I re-uploaded the audio to Libsyn as soon as this happened, figuring it had to have been on my end, maybe just a borked upload. No joy at all. Then I started poking the Libsyn interface, and I noticed that it was recognizing the correct file type and file size. No way could it do that if the file was borked when it got to them. If you haven't heard me complain about Libsyn before, this will be new to you. But get this, for a paid-for service, they provide no weekend tech support. And I always publish on weekends. The only good news at this point was that the Twitter name, @Libsyn, actually was paying attention and was very sympathetic. But the person behind the name was sad to tell me that he/she had no technical expertise and could not get it fixed for me. I'm not sure why that worked to calm me down, but it actually did. I felt at least like they felt bad. I opened a ticket with Libsyn and I went to bed. I sent an email first thing Monday morning to the president of Wizard Media, Rob Walch, and I was surprised to get an immediate response that he was escalating the ticket. I had noticed that it had come back as a priority 2 ticket, probably because it only affected a few people. But, you know, for me, it was kind of a priority 1 ticket. It actually did affect Tim Chatton as well, so I don't know how many people it did affect. Before 8 a.m., though, the problem was fixed and the show was finally available. So here's the thing. If you had followed me on Twitter, you would know all this. And if you subscribe to the No Silica Cast News, you also had an early warning system. If you want to be notified when things go borky, please subscribe to the No Silica Cast News by filling out the teeny tiny little form in the left sidebar over at podfeet.com. It's quick, it's easy, and I promise not to spam you. You'll get 1 email a week telling you the show came out on schedule, assuming that it did, or a notice that something went wrong. You also get special notices of contests and that sort of thing, but I do not spam you, I promise. Anyway, I hope this whole mess didn't ruin your week, but it was beyond my control. Well, I'm getting really excited about Macworld iWorld. This is the last call for the No Silica Castaways party on Friday night from 6 to 8 p.m. at Jillian's in the Metreon. So if you're going to be in San Francisco, make sure you register by clicking the No Silica Castaways Party 2012 link in the header over at podfeet.com. Or it's in the show notes I'm reading to you right now. You can enter then the double secret password, ScreenSteps, all lowercase letters. We'll be having people check this list to let people in because we had a really bad problem with people crashing the party last year. We have about twice as many people RSVP'd to the party as last year, so we're actually in a bigger, new room with a pool table. If you're not going to be there, there's a way to join virtually. We're going to try doing a Google Plus Hangout during the party, so check your time zones, circle me up, and watch our Twitter feed. We're going to use my Samsung Meteor mic this time and a set of headphones, so you'll actually be able to hear the people and they'll be able to hear you. Traditionally, what we've been doing is dragging the Mac around the room and let people wave, but nobody can hear the person talking, and the person talking just hears a bunch of noise. This time, we're going to have a virtual party going on, maybe a separate table, say, come on over and chat with the virtual members of the party. I hope that works to make you feel included. I'm now confident that Blindfolded will actually be a success. I got to tell you, there were times in the last 6 weeks that I was not at all sure. I did a full dry run of the pitch with a small group the other day, and they gave me some really good feedback, especially in crisping up the charts. I stink at charts, so that help was sorely needed. The only bad thing is that I just barely made it through in 45 minutes, and I have 45 minutes to do it. That was without any questions. The good news is I usually go way faster when I'm in the moment. I guess I get more nervous than I realize, so this might work out okay. I sure better get it in, get it right on time, though. I better be able to get into the room right on time, I mean, because if the person before me is like a moment late, I'm going to go out of my mind. We have a lot to set up beforehand, too. Remember, Steve will be recording the whole thing, so you'll be able to see it and hear it no matter where you are. If you're at the show, please come. I really want people to be there. If you're not coming, but you know people who are, tell them to come. 11 a.m. on Thursday, by the way. And under all circumstances, wish me luck, fingers crossed. Well, unless you've had your head under a rock, you've probably already heard about Apple's education announcement this week, where they claim to have reinvented the textbook. I wanted to walk through it a bit here and give you my perspective on what the tools are like and what I think it means to the industry. To recap, that's for those with their heads under the rocks, Apple announced a couple of big things. First, they announced that they have signed on the three largest U.S. textbook publishers, McGraw-Hill, Pearson, and Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. I haven't heard of Pearson, I think I've heard of Harcourt, and I've definitely heard of McGraw-Hill. Basically, every textbook I ever had in college was from them. But according to Apple, if you add the three of them together, they actually account for something like 90% of the textbook market. So this is going to be important that they're starting with these big suppliers, these big publishers. So the question is, what did they sign them on to do? They got them to agree to deliver educational titles in the iBookstore with quote-unquote, most priced at $14.99 or less. That's huge. Now, this new textbook section of the iBookstore would be fun by itself, but the next piece of the puzzle is the introduction of a tool called iBooks Author, which is free on OS X only and available immediately. This tool allows anyone to create interactive textbooks and distribute them through iBooks for sale or give away for free through any channel. I'll get into that a bit too later. Now, they were brilliant in this introduction phase. You can download iBooks 2 immediately on iPad and iPhone, and you can even download the first couple of chapters for free of several real textbooks made with iBooks Author. These things are amazing. Now, think about a textbook, say, on anatomy. In the olden days, it was just a description, then pretty soon they could make a drawing in black and white, then maybe they got to, say, a color photograph of a heart. Now, take it up a notch and imagine an electronic book where you can rotate the heart around in space, see the full shape of it, or even have it demonstrate in a live video how it pumps. Now, which would be more successfully stored in your brain or more useful when you became a doctor and pulled a heart out in your hands? I'm thinking that color image isn't so useful. The entire concept of electronic books thrills me to no end. I remember weighing Kyle's backpack when he was in school, and it weighed 45 pounds. Those backpacks were known to cause many back injuries, especially when kids carried backpacks on one shoulder because it looked cooler. Luckily, my kids never did that. I would have strangled them if I caught them doing it. Now, I know there's still a lot of unanswered questions about this, like who's paying for the $500 per kid device? And what happens when they get dropped, stolen, broken? Well, I think we can get past these things in a few years. There's ways to work that out. But what we can see now is the future this can bring. There's another thing on heavy backpacks. There were kids who didn't carry the 45-pound backpacks back and forth to school. I remember giving a ride to a young girl when Lindsay was in high school, and she was carrying a spiral notebook and a makeup kit. Lindsay's got her 45-pound backpack. This girl has a spiral notebook and a makeup kit. Her solution was not to carry the books at all, and consequently, not to study at all. Perhaps she never would study. That never would have studied, but I like to think she might have if it engaged her imagination and not weighed 45 pounds. Now, we haven't even talked about all the trees that we don't have to cut down. Could the ebook market actually reduce global warming? I don't know. I don't know how much books contribute to cutting down trees. What about the wasted time in schools? Remember the first day picking up your books? The students wait in these really long lines, but the librarians and other administrators spend hours and hours ahead of time organizing these giant stacks of books, making sure the kids get the right one and it's all organized well. That entire process at the beginning and when they return the books, that process vanishes. They don't have enough time today, and they don't have the money to pay the administration, so this just makes the work, poof, goes away. Maybe it's one line to pick up your iPad instead. Now, iPads will get lost as books got lost, but maybe not as often. I wonder, if I had to keep track of a history book, a subject I deplored, or an iPad, a device I adored, I guarantee that iPad would be more likely to be within fingertip reach of me. The pricing is interesting, too. From what I understand, high school textbooks cost around $100 plus or minus, and schools keep them for 5 years, or about $20 a year, not counting all of the administration costs of taking care of them. So a textbook at $15 would be cheaper, but of course I'm not taking into account the $500 device that goes on. I do think this would have made a lot more sense to start at the college level, since students are already used to buying books, not having books bought for them by the school, so the monetary model seems to make more sense there to me. The other interesting bit about this whole thing is wondering, why were the publishers so willing to jump on board? Now, don't get me wrong, I'm glad that they've jumped in instead of resisting and fighting progress like the record industry and the movie industry has avoided everything. But what is their motivation here? How about the utter elimination of the used textbook market? Like the administration costs, it simply disappears. That's got to have been a consideration. I, of course, immediately downloaded iBooks 2 and as many free chapters of books as I could find. I'd like to talk about a few observations on this. First of all, some of the books are better than others. Some animations are very simplistic and yet effective. Some have fancy pants videos that open when you open the book, which is cool the first time, but would you get sick of that? I don't know if you can get past it quickly or not. Some have tons of interaction, some have very little. All of the books created with iBooks Author allow the reader to highlight simply by dragging a finger across some text. I love this, mostly because I was raised with the absolute dictum that you never, ever, 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 ever write in a book. I can't undo this out of my brain, and I've always envied those who could do it, but I just can't do it. But in my own electronic book, why the heck not? Turns out you can erase your highlights too, so no guilt at all. The other cool thing about highlighting is that all of your highlights show up in an automatically created notes section of the book. No more fishing through the book to find that thing you marked. I love that. It also automatically creates study cards from those notes, so you can use them to refresh your memory of the bits you hoped were important before the big final exam. The day iBooks 2 came out, I showed one of the textbooks to a teacher friend of mine. While I was demoing it, I accidentally double-tapped on a word, and right above it, it said speak. She squealed with delight, explaining that she has some special ed kids who very much have the capacity to learn as long as they can hear it out loud, but they can't read. She was thrilled that they would be able to learn just as easily as anyone else. My buddy Ron and I got into a discussion about this the other night. He was talking about how natural selection in our world today allows those who can read, those who learn how to study written language, to do better in our society. Now with the advent of multimedia books, the playing field may have changed dramatically, allowing those who learn visually or through audio or through movement to have the same advantages in learning. It's a whole new ballgame, isn't it? I mean, to say they've reinvented the textbook market might actually be true. I do have to say a few critical things about the iBooks 2 application itself. It's a little bit buggy. It crashes a bit, locked up twice on me, where I actually had to reboot my iPad twice in the first day. But I guess I can forgive Apple on a first-release application that changes the world. They better come out with some quick updates, though. I won't be quite as reasonable in a few months if it's still crashing. Let's switch gears a little bit here and talk about iBooks Author itself. Like I said, it's free to download from the Mac App Store. To start, you choose one of the preset themes. I think it's a little odd that you can't choose from a blank slate, but I suppose this is sort of in a teaching mode for now. I'm still trying to figure out what all the elements of the themes are to be able to tell which one I would pick, but that'll come with time. The themes come pre-populated with a book title page, a chapter, and a section, and a page within a section. They've thrown in junk text, also known as Lorem Ipsum. Oddly, you can't edit this text. As soon as you click on it, the entire text of the entire book is selected, and you can only replace or delete it. That confused me at first, but I guess it makes sense. If you drag in a photo, it automatically wraps the text around your photo just like it does in Pages. By the way, does anyone know why it doesn't do that in Keynote? Anyway, to add more interesting content, go to the widgets in the toolbar. You can choose Media and then drag in Movies directly onto the page. Now, I haven't yet narrowed down what codecs it likes. I have quite a few .movs that it refuses, some MP4s it refuses, and some M4vs that it does seem to like. I thought about studying it to try to find a pattern, but I figure somebody else will do it for me if I procrastinate, so I don't have to figure it out. Let me know when one of you guys figures it out, okay? Unfortunately, the pop-up denial box that you get when you drag in the wrong kind of video only tells you to open QuickTime and re-encode, but it doesn't tell you what codecs it does want to see. I think it should. I really like the gallery widget, by the way. Insert a gallery widget and then drag a bunch of photos at once into it. When viewed on iOS, you get one image with a series of dots below it showing you how many images you have, and you can swipe or tap to flip through them. I love this. You can insert widgets for review questions, Keynote, which really works well, interactive images where you can tap on different parts to learn more, and 3D images. Now, I don't have access to any of the tools to make or view 3D images, but it allows you to play with the image by spinning just about the vertical axis, just about the horizontal axis, or a complete 3D free rotation. If you're a real geek, you can also insert an HTML widget. Like iBooks 2, I found bugs in iBooks Author. I had the most trouble when figuring out how you make your book work well in both landscape and portrait modes. When you view in landscape, your images flow right in the body of the text. They refer to portrait mode, though, as read-only mode or something like that. So the images don't interrupt the flow of the text. They live in the left sidebar of the page, so they're not so distracting. The problem I ran into was that only some of my images would show up in that left sidebar, and I couldn't figure out why that was. I suppose this potentially could be operator trouble. I'm always open to that, but I'm not really sure. I didn't actually always get the text to float around the images too, but deleting and re-adding the same image did allow it to float nicely. Probably one of the coolest features of the usability of iBooks Author is the preview mode. Click that and a window pops up showing any connected iPads. Click on your iPad in the list and it will warn you to make sure iBooks is open on the iPad. Once you've done that, iBooks Author renders the book and it comes up on the iPad so you can play with it. So you actually get to open the book. So much cooler than the simulator they do in Xcode. The end user license agreement of iBooks Author says that you can only sell your book via iBookstore after signing a contract with them, but you can give away your book any way you like. A lot of people are flipped out about this, but I don't understand why. They're giving you the tools for free, and you remain free to create your books any way you like to sell in other places, just not with the tool they gave you for free. So if Adobe comes out with a tool, go ahead, use that. If Amazon comes out with a tool, go ahead and use that. Do it in Microsoft Word, for crying out loud, if you dare. If you want to make books for Android, go ahead. Expecting Apple to give you this tool for free and then allow you to sell your books through someone else is really kind of naive, I think. They're a business, not a charity. They have never pretended to be in this for the good of their souls. They may be pushing that they're doing this particular thing for the children, but don't be fooled. They're in it for the money, and they have never promised otherwise. I see nothing wrong with what they've done here, and I didn't even for a heartbeat expect it to come out any different than that. I have some big plans of what I'm going to do with iBooks Author. Lots of fun to be had with this new tool. If you haven't ever heard of Blue Mango Learning and their great products ScreenSteps and Clarify, then I sure haven't been doing my job around here. Both of these tools are designed to help you write instructions with images and annotations, and that helps you teach other people how to do things on the computer. The difference between the two is that Clarify is for quick one-off instructions, like teaching someone how to set up their IMAP mail account, for example. But ScreenSteps is for writing documentation manuals, you know, more heavy lifting kind of stuff. I love both of these tools, and I use each one for its intended purpose. I wasn't sure that made sense when I first heard about it, but it's very natural when you think about the kind of thing you're going to do, you just go left or right. You know which one to use. Now, for you, you may only need one or the other, but you can check them out because both tools are cross-platform and work on Windows and Mac, which must make Nightwise happy. They have these free trials, so you have no excuse not to give them a try. Head on over to BlueMangoLearning.com and make sure you tell them that Allison sent you.
Hi, this is Ken Wolf from the New Manhattan Repertory Theater in New York City. Here are some more Mac apps and iOS apps that were instrumental in teleporting Manhattan Rep to our new space. The task manager I used was the Mac daddy of all task managers, OmniFocus, from the Omni Group, www.omnigroup.com. Now, I've been using OmniFocus for a little over 2 years, and it has literally changed my life. When my theater exploded from the sound and we procured the new space, I immediately did a major brain dump into OmniFocus, where I just typed in every single thing that I could imagine that needed to be done. Then I put start dates on when things needed to be done so that they would appear in OmniFocus on the days when I needed to do them. This way I wouldn't have a huge daunting list that would freak me out. I would just have the list for the things I needed to do that day. If I didn't accomplish everything each day, I could easily move them to another day. OmniFocus has ever worked seamlessly, keeping me on track and on target of all the myriad of things that I needed to do. Now, OmniFocus does so much more than this. So if you'd like to learn more, please check out MacSparky.com. David Sparks, the other podcasting half to Katie Floyd of the Mac Power Users podcast, has three wonderful OmniFocus screencasts, which are super great and really easy to understand. The links will be in the show notes. Now, there can be a big difference between a task manager and a list manager. The list manager I used is an iOS application called List. And that is List with an exclamation point. List is developed by Gary Riley, and it is an awesome universal app for both iPhone and iPad. The difference between List and many other list managers is that List can do lists with nested folders. So, for example, I had a folder for Home Depot, all the stuff I needed to do for the reconstruction of the theater, and nested in that list was a folder that said Tools. Another that said paint, another that said electric, and in those folders were the list for all the individual items that I needed for that area of the store. This way, when the OmniFocus task appeared that said, go to Home Depot and buy stuff, I would go to Home Depot and then use List. Each folder for each different area of the store. So efficient and so easy. List has a number of other features, including icons that you can assign to folders, little computers, teddy bears, dollar signs, and more. It has the ability to email any and all of your lists, and it has alarms and more. And List has a gorgeous UI. The only downside to List is that it does not sync to the Mac or to other iOS devices. One of the cool things I did was to use PhotoStream. At night, I would research tools and such on my iPad, take a screen grab of the item, and the next day at Home Depot, I would have that information on my PhotoStream on my iPhone. I'm with you, Allison. I love PhotoStream. It was 2 days before we had to open the theater. I'm standing on a ladder holding a huge costume rack with one side already screwed into the wall. As I'm getting ready to drill into the plaster wall so that I can secure the rack on one side, I realize I forgot to level it. And my level was in the next room, and in order to get it, I'd have to pull out the other side or let it slide down and crash to the floor. Oh, not fun! Then I remember I downloaded some carpentry apps from iTunes. Holding the level secure, I pulled out my iPhone from my back pocket and I opened iHandy Level Free from iHandy Soft Inc., a free level app that works amazingly well. It is a wonderful level that works with the accelerometer in the iPhone. There's a visual level that looks exactly like one of those water levels, and then there is a digital readout above it that will give you the exact digital level. And because the sides of the iPhone 4 and the iPhone 4S are flat, it works so amazingly well. I set the level, drilled, screwed in the plaster bolt, and I was on my way. One of the best tech tools in teleporting my theater for me was Google. Yes, Google. Apple's sometime nemesis. I don't know from electric how wires and dimmer boards work, so I Googled and found a solution. I have no idea how to drill and secure theatrical lighting into plaster in a 100-year-old historical building, so I Googled and found a solution. Google gave me real, practical, and quick solutions to carpentry, masonry, and electrical problems. Without it, I am sure Manhattan Rep would have closed. So we did it. We teleported our theater. It took 10 days for the building contractors to pull down two concrete walls, and it took us exactly 1 week to teleport Manhattan Rep. And it never would have happened without my Apple tech, Google, and the power of possibility. What a wonderful life it is.
Well, this has been really, really interesting, Ken. I got to tell you, I love iHandy Free Level. I actually use it at the gym. I wonder why some days my runs seem to be so much harder than others. That got me wondering, what if one of the treadmills was a level? Sure enough, the first two of the set that I usually use were way off, and I was running uphill. I now dial down the machine until my iPhone tells me it's level. I like what you talk about thinking about possibilities when you're working on a project like this. My brother Grant is hilarious. When he's working on a project, you will constantly hear this ranting stream of how whatever he's trying to do is completely impossible, and he actually always figures it out. It's really funny. He takes it from the other side, is to just scream at the world that this thing is so hard, whatever it is he's trying to do. I also like that you bring up how good Google is. You know, for some reason, when something becomes dominant, we decide to hate it, and it just kind of becomes a fad. I don't know about you guys, but I use Google all the time for everything. There's some times lately that I use Twitter because it's faster, but giving Google its due for how much it does for us, what it helps us find, I think that's spot on. Anyway, congratulations on all your work, Ken. I'm glad that whole thing finally worked out for you.
As the young beauty at Starbucks balanced coffee, designer bag, and iPhone, the iPhone slipped from her hand and hit the ceramic tile floor with a distressing crunch. When she picked it up, the front screen was badly fractured. Not surprising, since her iPhone was as naked as the day Steve Jobs approved its iconic design, complete with black glass front and back. A week earlier, I had been in a skyscraper closing a multi-lawyer deal. One banker had a brand new iPhone 4S, but couldn't make or receive calls, even though we were up in the sky in a room with large windows. Not surprising, since her iPhone was encased in so much aluminum, it was combat hardened. The iPhone is only a bit heavier than my aged Nexus One, a phone that always connects, and I've dropped harmlessly to concrete several times. Then, I don't carry it naked or surrounded by enough aluminum to build a strategic bomber. My preferred case is silicone jelly. The most important advantage of silicone jelly is that it bounces, offering real drop protection. Jelly cases are light and stretch on and off easily, useful for fitting a phone into a dock. They don't block signals. They have a slight adhesive effect that makes them far less likely to slip from the hand. They're really, really cheap, come in lots of colors, and are sold by Amazon, where buying through the link at podfeet.com supports the NoSilicast. Some are less than $2, though the leading brand is Amzer, A-M-Z-E-R, and theirs are about $10. Their slight adhesion is the only drawback I've found with silicone jelly. Just as your phone won't slide easily out of your hand, it won't slide easily into a tight pocket. TPU silicone skin offers much less protective bounce than jelly, but it will slip into a tight pocket and will protect covered parts of the phone from scratches and light whacks. Both silicone jelly cases and TPU skin cases are available for many kinds of phones, as well as tablets, including iPads. For a different selection than Amazon's, visit Amzer's own websites for cases, phone, and tablet accessories. As always, links in the show notes.
Thanks, George. You know, I actually haven't ever tried one of these silicone cases. I did shatter my iPhone once, though, and I don't really want to live through that again. Now, one thought about the skyscraper problem. It's also possible that the signal from the carrier would not make it up that high. Where I work, we have a 12-story building where cell phones do not work above the third floor. If the company, building owner, or service providers don't provide in-building repeaters, I believe that's what makes the signal drop off the higher you go up. Now, you didn't say whether other phones from the same carrier did work, so that might have been the cause was the metal case she had on, but that might have been the cause if not. I just bought a spec case because it gives me a smooth plastic case plus a rubber flange that sticks up around the screen. I'm hoping this will protect my phone a little bit better. I might try one of these silicone jelly cases anyway. For $10, that'd be the cheapest case I ever bought. John Costanzo wrote in this week to tell me how much he loves Text Expander. He uses it for his programming, and he finds it really useful to use small snippets to replace big or annoying gobs of code. He has a problem, though, that he has to use Windows at work, so he misses all that efficiency. He found a free for personal use app called Phrase Express at phraseexpress.com. Now, that might actually be pretty cool, but that's not a good substitute for a work environment because it does say for personal use. But it might be good for you if you're a Windows home user. This app does allow him to import his settings file for Text Expander, but it doesn't stay up to date if he adds any new snippets on the Mac side or the Windows side. Now, I add new snippets all the time, so that would drive me crazy, too. I told him that the great folks at Smile have worked very closely with Patrick from 16software.com, maker of Breevy for Windows. These two companies worked together to figure out how to have your snippets synced back and forth between Windows and Mac on Dropbox. It makes me like Text Expander even better. I mean, it's just awesome because I can do that. Patrick is cool. The Smile folks are awesome. So the two of them working together on opposite platforms makes everybody win. If you aren't yet addicted to Text Expander, check out the free trial over at smilesoftware.com and be sure to tell them that you heard about it here. When you're ready to buy, click the affiliate link in the show notes or the link in the left sidebar that also takes you there to buy it in the Mac App Store for all of your Macintosh needs. Well, it's that time of the week again. It's time for Chit Chat Across the Pond with Bart Bouchotz. Lovely to talk to you today, Bart. I am really excited about the topic today.
Excited? Not the word I use for it. I get more animated about it than excited. But
well, I should say I'm excited about learning about it from you rather than pretending I know what I'm talking about. I plan on knowing what I'm talking about when we're done here. So that's why I'm excited. I've been looking forward to it all week. So before we get into our main topic, though, Security Light, what's going on?
Actually, surprisingly little. Last time we spoke, it was just before Patch Tuesday, so that's two Tuesdays ago now. So if you haven't yet, you know, woken up all your Microsoft stuff and let it update itself and your Adobe stuff, then do that. But other than that, there's not really much to say.
Okay, good, good. So we done with security?
Not quite. We have a sort of I've called it security medium. I was sort of the aim of Security Light was always that it would sort of have people think reflexively about security and that it would sort of always be in their peripheral vision. So picture the scene. I'm cycling along on my mountain bike through a nice wooded path, and I hear, listening to the noise telecast as always, and I hear Alison talking about helping people out with Tiger. And I'm saying, no, any second now, we're going to get to the important bit here. There's an elephant in this room, any second now, and then the topic ended. I'm like,
I suck, Bart.
I
feel terrible because I thought about it. You know, when I first read what she wrote, I remember thinking 10.5. Wait a minute, 10.5. That's Tiger, and then I forgot.
10.5 is Leopard, but
or it's Leopard.
Yeah, there was mention of Tiger too. 10.5 is Leopard. 10.4 is Tiger.
Oh, well, so did I say something about Tiger?
I definitely think Tiger was mentioned.
Oh, okay.
But it doesn't really matter because Tiger and Leopard are effectively the same thing. But from the point of view of this discussion.
Oh, okay. Okay, so...
So the elephant in the corner of the room is that whether it's 10.4, 10.5, 10.3, 10.2, 10.1, 10.0, anything that isn't 10.6 or 10.7 is no longer supported by Apple. Therefore, it is physically impossible to be safe on a machine that is on an unsupported operating system if you have a network cable plugged into it.
But Leopard is still supported.
No, Snow Leopard is.
Leopard's not supported?
No, Leopard's gone too. Yeah, it's always this one and one back.
Oh my gosh, I thought it was only Snow. Okay. Then I wasn't paying attention either.
So the PowerPC users are sort of hanging on there by the tips of their fingers because the last OS X to support PowerPC is Snow Leopard.
Mm.
So the next time, so in about a year, year and a half from now, when 10.8 rolls around, the PowerPC people will either have to upgrade their hardware or switch to Linux.
Hmm. Wow.
So I thought basically it might be a good time to sort of... I think people know that reflexively when... Anyone who listens to me on many podcasts knows that as soon as I hear someone say, and I have this old Mac and I think I'm going to downgrade to Leopard because... I say, no, stop. You know, I'll march straight in there and say, no. But I thought maybe it might be time to take a few minutes to explain the why. Instead of just the no. And I guess the why is just because of the nature of how things are nowadays. So in the olden days, we didn't patch anything really, did we? I mean, do you remember installing patches for Windows 3.1?
No.
Windows 95.
Remember, I never used Windows until Vista.
Okay, well, even in older versions of the Mac OS, like, I mean, this idea of patching your OS every month or two,
that didn't happen, right? Right, right.
Because we weren't all interconnected. We were all these little islands, and the only way stuff came in or out of us was on, you know, we carried it there ourselves on disks, and we always need to be very careful with those disks.
Right.
But nowadays, the vast majority of content we see hasn't come from our machine. It's come to us through the internet. You know, we watch videos on YouTube. We look at photographs on the net. We look at email. I mean, everything we're looking at is coming to us from outside of our computer. So we aren't on an island anymore. So updates have taken on a whole new level of importance. But the very fundamental level of all of this, this interconnectedness means that we're playing in a dangerous playground. But what are the dangers? Well, all software is written by people. All people make mistakes. So all software has mistakes in it. That is just a fact of life. There's no point in pretending otherwise. When you learn to software and testing, one of the golden rules you're taught is that there's always one more bug to find. You never found the last one.
You just run asymptotic to finished?
Yeah, there's always one more in there somewhere. So in our normal life of our software these days, it's a constant fight between people finding the flaws and the flaws being fixed, and people finding the flaws and the flaws being fixed, and people finding the flaws and the flaws being fixed, which is why we have this constant cycle of patch, 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 patch. Flaw found, flaw fixed, flaw found, flaw fixed. And that's just the normal flow of, that's the status quo now. It's, we're always pedaling to stay still. But the moment you're in an operating system that is out of support, one half of that equation vanishes. And every new problem found is unpatched forever. And the problem is that those unpatched problems, they'll keep being found for a number of reasons. First off, because most of the code in our OSs is reused. So just because you might think that, well, Tiger is now obsolete, therefore no one's testing Tiger to find new bugs. The problem is bugs found in Lion probably affect Tiger too. Unless they're bugs with the additions that were added to Lion that don't exist in Tiger. But lots and lots and lots of Tiger's code is in Lion. Okay. Therefore, lots of the code that's in Lion is in Tiger too, whatever way you want to look at that. I mean, there's still Windows 3.1 code in Windows 7. You know, and given that we're using a Unix-based OS, there's probably code in Lion that goes back to the 1970s.
Right, BSD.
Yeah, the old BSD stuff. I mean, there's old code around here. So the flaws being found in the later versions of OS X, much of it still affects the older versions. And then you also have the fact that some of the flaws found aren't even in software, they're in protocols. And if you don't get the updates to the implementations of the protocol, then those protocol flaws still affect you. So you can't stand still while the rest of the world carries on, because those flaws are still being found. And when they're found, they're not obscure, they're added to these toolkits where stuff like Metasploit, you don't actually need to have any understanding of anything to use Metasploit. Basically, you know, 5 minutes reading the manual, sitting in Starbucks, and you can start hacking, because Metasploit automates it all. So you just simply say, take this module, and point it at that machine, and then it will just execute the various known exploits.
That's nice that we've been able to automate and give these toolkits to the hackers. That's great.
Well, the thing is, we're not giving them to the hackers. We're giving them to the defenders.
Oh, okay.
But, of course, where is the line between a defender and a hacker? Like, the software doesn't have morals. It's how you use it that has morals. So these toolkits are there so that you can test your own stuff. Because the simple fact is, if the good guys know it, the bad guys know it too. So there's no point in trying to keep it secret.
Sure.
Because the bad guys are much better at getting at secrets than the good guys are. So that's why these toolkits are there. They're not toolkits to help people hack, but they're certainly toolkits that make it trivial for any known vulnerability to be attacked. So patched people don't have to worry about these things because they're patched. So the fact that they're in Metasploit is irrelevant.
Right.
But unpatched people, the fact that they're in Metasploit is very, very important. Because literally a 10-year-old, 5 minutes to spare, and you're hosed, you know? So I just thought to sort of bring the point home that these flaws are in everything. Absolutely, absolutely everything. So just in the last few years, stuff that has been patched in OS X, the JPEG, TIFF, and PNG libraries have been patched repeatedly and regularly. So viewing a picture on a web page in an email is enough to get you hacked if you're not patched. Video codecs, everyone you can shake a stick at, has been patched repeatedly. PDF libraries, the libraries for dealing with zip files, the libraries for dealing with disk images, the protocols for streaming, DNS, Samba, Bonjour, they've all been patched. And entire programming environments like Java and Flash, which are still bundled into the older versions of the OSs like Tiger and Leopard. Oh. And that's just like off the top of my head, all of these things. So you can't possibly tell me that anyone can use their computer without doing any of those things.
Right, right. There's too many of them. It's basically everything, like you said.
It's so, everything.
So how do you approach a friend, a relative that – I mean, I figure most people listening to the show are probably doing the right thing and upgrading, but mostly because we're all addicted to the coolest new thing and we want it. How do you approach a friend, a family member and say – yeah, I mean, do you refuse to help them if they don't do what you say or
– Well, no. You sit there and you have this picture and say, look, what you're doing is the digital equivalent of driving without a seatbelt.
Mm.
This is – dangerous, and it's not a matter of if you're going to get hit, it's a matter of when. And you could get lucky. You have people who drive without seatbelts their entire lives, smoke 40 a day, and drink like a fish. And they get away with it.
But statistics are not on your side.
The statistics are very, very much not on your side. So you would say, look, this is the problem, and the solution is that you need to stay updated. So
let me help
if their hardware is fairly new, that's not actually painful. Mm-hmm. That's generally a case of, with Apple users, that's generally a case of 29 books. It was 29 for Lion, wasn't it?
I think so. I know it was 29 for 19. Snow Leopard.
It was very little. Like
Chump change.
It was well south of $50.
Mm-hmm.
So you said to people, look, every twice 18 months you have to do this. So twice 18, because you don't have to go, you can be too behind. So you can upgrade to Lion, then skip the next update, then update to whatever comes after that. So you can go 10.8, you could have gone 10.2, 10.4, 10.6, 10.8 would be a valid route. So you don't even have to do them all. So you're saying every 18 months a new OS comes out, so you have to do it about once every 3 years. You're spending about £30. You know, it's not actually...
But the problem is the hardware, right?
The problem is when you get to people who don't really use their computer very hard. They check their mail and they surf the web. They do a bit of Facebooking and that kind of stuff. That makes them really big targets. But it means they're not actually particularly hard users of the machine. So the hardware is fine long after it's been abandoned.
Mm.
And that's going to cause us trouble with the PowerPC people who have perfectly good G4s. And they're going to run into problems. They may not have enough RAM to run Snow Leopard. Or they simply just may not be able to. If you have a G3, you're out. And at that stage, you have to sit there and say, look, if you want to be safe, you're either going to spend money on something like a cheap netbook, which will do everything you need, or an iPad, or a second-hand computer. But what you're on now is unsecurable. You cannot be safe doing this. So we need to find a way for you to get what you need with spending as little money as you can.
And those big major hardware shifts don't happen all that often, right?
Well, they don't. I mean, you know, at this stage, the PowerPC is, what, at least 5 years old?
At least, yeah.
So even if you have the very latest PowerPC, you've had a machine for 5 years of sterling use. You're not quite, it's not that you're being ripped off at this stage, really.
Right, right.
You know, it's had a good innings. Unfortunately, its time has passed. The other option is you can just stick one of the PowerPC Linuxes on it. If all they do is surf the web and check email, you put Firefox and Thunderbird on and they're sorted.
Yeah, good point.
You know, and so you have Yellow Dog and some of the... There are Linuxes that happen to support PowerPC, and there are Linuxes just for the PowerPC. So you have no problem getting a Linux onto it, and Firefox will run, Thunderbird will run. So away you go.
It makes me think, you know, my friend Ron is about to sell a PowerBook G4. What's the responsible thing to do to it? You know, sell it with Tiger or Leopard, or do you put it with or do you put Linux on it before you do it?
Well, ethically speaking, I'd be inclined to say, well, it depends on who you're selling it to. If you're selling it to a nerd,
complete stranger,
the responsibility is not on your end.
Complete stranger.
Yeah, ethically speaking, I'd be inclined to at least put Snow Leopard on it. On the one hand, you can say, look, caveat emptor.
Caveat emptor. Yeah. Well, I think in this case, if he got $30 for it, that would be a good deal, right? Like, I just checked Gazelle, it's only worth recycling.
Yeah,
they won't give you any money at all.
If you sell something for $30, your responsibility is minimal, frankly.
Right.
If you buy something for $30, you really shouldn't expect a lot. So if you sell something for $30, you know, I think you're being pretty honest about the value there.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. Okay, well, I think we've got a big topic going here, so we should probably move on. But I promise not to say the word tiger without saying, but you better get him off of that right away.
And you can add leopard onto that list as well.
And
mentally.
Leopard, yeah, I didn't even think of that. By the way, I did check leopard or lion is $30 for your whole household.
So it's $29.
Yeah.
And I think it was 19 euro that translated to, which is probably where I'm getting the 19 from.
Nice. All right.
Okay, so you asked me to talk to you about SOPA and PIPA. I think you just said SOPA, but I'm one of those people who thinks it's very, very, very important to say both of those acronyms together.
Okay. So
less important as of this week's activities.
Yeah, we're a little thrown for a loop here because there has been big news about the changes in what's happening. But the reason I wanted to talk to you was because I knew that if I asked you about it, I'd be able to get not the fear, uncertainty, and doubt, the FUD from either side. I believe that there's probably been a lot of people who are just like, the internet's going to stop tomorrow. You know, okay, well, no, not tomorrow, but here is what would happen kind of thing. So
yeah, there is certainly some sky falling stuff. And there's a lot of confusion as well, actually, because I've seen, you probably saw that Mega Upload were shut down by the federal government.
Right.
And people are saying, look at what SOPA's done.
Yeah, right. And I believe 13 million people called their Congress people on Wednesday, and I'm pretty darn sure 13 million people didn't have a reasonable depth of understanding of what the law meant. I mean, God bless them and all, but...
Well, in fairness, when you're going to regulate something, the onus is the other way around. If there's a law being voted on, you don't know what it does, then it should be stopped unless someone can tell you that it's a good idea.
Sure. Sure.
So when it comes to legislation, I think it's important that the burden of proof is very much on those proposing the law and very much not on those opposing it.
Right.
But anyway, that's not there. So
before we get started, the one thing we need to say is that these two bills have been stopped for now. They're not on the table to be voted for.
The acronyms are dead.
Right. the acronyms are dead.
Associated with this week's very effective protest. And no senator or congressman heading into the elections in November wants to be associated with a vote for SOPA or PIPA.
Okay.
So we should say SOPA stands for Stop Online Privacy Act, and that is... Stop Online Privacy Act.
No, and that's Stop Online Piracy.
In the House of Representatives.
Okay. You keep saying privacy, it's piracy.
Piracy. Sorry, that's just me misspeaking. My brain is saying piracy. Privacy. Stop online privacy. No, we don't want that. Stop online.
That would be really scary.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's a bill. It was a bill being debated and prepared in the House of Representatives in the United States. And then its counterpart was the Protect IP Act, or PIPA, which was a Senate bill doing basically the same thing, only in the Senate instead of the House. Okay. And that in itself causes confusion because a lot of people were really against SOPA and had no idea what PIPA was. And my big fear until this week's actions were that everyone would be outraged against SOPA, PIPA would pass the Senate, and then the House would just pass PIPA.
And nobody would notice.
And nobody would notice. So in some ways, PIPA was sort of a stalking horse there, but both have been pretty well killed by this week's protests. So these legislations, these two bills were written by lobbyists for the content industry as an attempt to patch, from their point of view, the loophole that the American DMCA is not a worldwide law.
Before we get too far into that, one of the things I did want to make sure I understand when I'm done, because Steve and I can sit and have this argument ad infinitum, is whether this is about internal U.S. sites or whether it's about external U.S. sites or external sites to the U.S.
Officially, as in the stated aim of the law is external sites, but the wording is so vague that the considered legal opinion of many people looking at the wording is that it would affect all sites.
Okay. Maybe that's part of the confusion.
That's certainly part of the confusion. So on the stated aim is outside sites only, but when lawyers look at the wording, they say, okay, that may be your aim, but what you've written here on the page is not that.
And it specifically, I believe, had to do with sites that were registered under U.S. domains like .com. But one of the things I read pointed out that thepiratebay.com would have been okay, wouldn't have been part of this because that's registered in the U.S. But something like twit.tv, which is
Tuvalu,
right, that would have been under this. So saying it's a U.S. company doesn't even mean anything.
Well, I don't think that's – I think that may be a level of confusion there because I think – well, then again, it all depends on how they wrote the bill. Now, the thing we have to say, right? These were proposed legislation, so they were fluid. They were not. They've never been set in stone at any point in their existence.
Okay.
So the wording has been constantly chopping and changing and being amended and changed as this moved through the legislative process. I mean, these bills were very much at the sausage being made stage. They were not voted on. They were not passed by either house. They were not consolidated, and they were not signed by the president. So these bills were stopped very early in the process before they really solidified into exact wording.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of the problems with the specifics, it's easy to get sidetracked into lots of these specifics where they may have accidentally said something which meant that .tv was considered outside, even though Leo Laporte is, you know, even though like twit.tv is very much US-based. Those are kind of the little details, and they were definitely changing all the time, because at one stage the law actually explicitly said that it would be DNS blacklisting until everyone went, wait a hoot a minute, that's going to break DNSSEC, and that's going to ruin all of the security we've spent the last 5 years trying to create here. And, you know, three-letter acronym organizations dealing with security were coming out against it, and then they changed that. So it's been very fluid. So I think it's important to avoid getting stuck in the teeny tiny details, because they've been changing all along anyway. That what you actually want to do is you want to step back and look at the big picture.
Okay.
So the thing to understand is the motivation here. So the Digital Millennium Copyright Act gives significant powers to the content owners within the confines of the United States. And it's certainly been abused, but it has certainly had a significant effect on what goes on US sites. I certainly wouldn't be a big fan of the DMCA. It got many things wrong. It did get some things right, like the safe harbor provisions. It got those right. But it got a lot wrong, and it's abused a lot. But that's a comment for different. The problem is the DMCA is limited to America. And the rights industry do not like this, so they want something to deal with outside America. And their idea is a mandatory blacklist that ISPs in America would have to obey. So they can't reach outside of America and kill the site, so instead they're going to reach to the ISPs and make the ISPs block them. That's the logic.
Okay, so this is what bothers me. Steve and I, again, were arguing about this, trying to understand. If this is so horrifically evil and breaks everything, why mm-hmm. does it the DMCA not already horrifically break everything?
Well, there's a couple of differences. The DMCA is file-based, whereas this is domain-based. So with the DMCA, you can easily run sites like Flickr, Twitter, and all these kind of things, because the way it works is when someone... The burden of work is mostly put on the people trying to get stuff taken down. So you make a big movie, you search the internet, you find that someone has hosted a link to it on their Twitter. You send Twitter a DMCA takedown notice, and if Twitter respond, they are immune from prosecution. So if Twitter then take it down, they're immune from prosecution, the content is gone, everyone's happy.
Oh, okay, but it doesn't say take down that whole domain.
It does not say take down the whole domain. So the thing with Pippa and SOPA is that it's about blacklisting domains. So Twitter, all of Twitter would be killed if an order was put in against any content on Twitter. All of Flickr would be killed.
Oh.
The other thing is there's no safe harbor provision. So the safe harbor provision makes the DMCA workable if unideal. So if you operate a service in good faith, you are considered as innocent of what goes on that service as the telephone companies are of what phone calls are made. So when terrorists use the phone network to plan something, the phone network is not held responsible because they're considered to be an impartial carrier.
Okay.
And the safe harbor provision in the DMCA takes that same logic to people who run websites. So Flickr are not legally culpable when a user of Flickr breaks copyright law. Flickr have the responsibility to respond to the DMCA takedown notice, and if they breach that, then they lose their safe harbor, and they are deemed then to become responsible for the illegal content. But as long as they obey the law, they're safe. But with Pippa, there is no such thing as a safe harbor provision. So suddenly the burden flips, and anyone trying to set up a site has to pre-vet everything any user creates. So all user content would have to be pre-vetted because there is no safe harbor.
And that's
impossible. How do you have innovation on the internet when you cannot allow users create content?
So George from Tulsa sends me a review, and he links to a site, and that site has somehow been deemed to have illegal content. Somebody turns us in, and all of a sudden I've lost. Podfeet.com is gone.
In theory, yeah. So the other thing then, so the lack of safe harbor provision is a problem for services like Flickr, Twitter, those kind of things to get off the ground. Or Blogger would really be in trouble. But the other problem you have is that the law, as written, also made it illegal to link to blacklisted sites. So simply having a link to something which then later gets blacklisted makes you criminal.
Hmm.
And then puts your domain in jeopardy.
Is there also the problem of no due process?
That is certainly something that I have on the list, is that this would very much be an executive branch-driven thing, sort of customs and excise kind of level rather than judicial. So this wouldn't be a judge ordering a site shut down, but I believe it's the Attorney General's office would initially. From my read, now I could be wrong about that. I meant to double-check that. But when I read on Thursday, I thought that's what I read.
Hmm.
So it's executive branch rather than judicial branch. And that in itself is a worry. Then the other obvious problem is it doesn't seem to put a very large amount of responsibility on the executive branch to try to contact the owners of the domain and come to a reasonable resolution before just going ahead and blacklisting them. And if the law doesn't put that onus there, then sure, at first it may be well implemented. But if the letter of the law doesn't say that you have to do that, then the next administration can just say, yeah, whatever, we're just going to arbitrarily block stuff. And something that a lot of people have commented on is there's very loose language in all of these proposed bills. And that kind of loose language leaves this stuff open to abuse, both in terms of corporate abuse, in the sense of shutting down your competitors abroad, and also in terms of free speech abuse, where corporations can start to stamp out speech they don't like. Or worse still, the government could start to stamp out speech it doesn't like. And, you know, just tag some... You find a far-fetched link to intellectual property somewhere, and then boom, you know?
Your competitor's gone.
Or you shut down the people saying things you don't like.
What I don't understand is...
So from both a free speech and a free trade point of view, it causes issues.
So there's a lot of problems in the world and in the United States, right? We got your poverty, your joblessness, we got horrible banking problems, companies going out of business, we got wars. Why is this such a huge thing to the government that we better fix this?
Because the government have been bought and paid for by the large corporations, quite literally.
Yeah.
Since Citizens United, there is no limit on the corporate buyout of government. So it's very expensive to get elected in the United States of America because you can't, you need massive amounts of money to get airtime because you can't possibly meet in person the entire populace of the United States. Like, that just doesn't work. If you're in Delaware or something, you can be a congressman and you can probably meet most of the people in your district. But that doesn't really work when you get to the level of being a senator for Florida, let alone being president of America. So corporate money is very important to politics, and because there are no limits on corporate donations, you have massive donations being made by the movie and music industry, and frankly, they expect payback.
Hmm.
I mean, money corrupts, and it's not nice to have to say that, but really, sure, money is having undue influence.
So
this shouldn't be a priority, but if it were the case that, like the automotive industry, the movie industries were on the brink of bankruptcy and hundreds of thousands of jobs literally were at stake here, then you could understand this massive reaction. But I'm seeing record profits from these industries. Whereas, but to be honest, that's kind of a political question.
Sure.
Which,
yeah.
I'm not sure if that's
what I don't need to get into.
So I actually want to step back a bit to the sort of fundamental problems with the whole idea. The idea here is to blacklist sites. If blacklists actually worked, there would be no spam in the world. No viruses in the world. Blacklists have proven themselves over and over again not to work. And the entire history of the internet is a history of the failure of blacklists. In the olden days, firewalls worked by blacklisting troubled ports, and firewalls were very ineffective. Nowadays, corporate firewalls are whitelist-based. Everything is considered malicious unless we explicitly allow it in. Whitelists work, blacklists don't. Now, you can't whitelist the internet. Right? because then you're into right. state censorship at a level that's unbelievable.
Not to mention it's a lot of work.
Yeah, so whitelisting the internet is just impossible, and at the end of the day, the whole concept of the internet just wouldn't hold up to that anyway. So blacklisting, though, is what this bill is based on. It is literally an internet blacklist. Blacklists do not work. Ask Hosni Mubarak how well he got on with blacklisting the internet. Did he manage to succeed in stopping his citizens from accessing the sites he didn't want them to access so that they could spread the videos and stuff that told us what was happening in Tahrir Square? He failed. Do you think that the pirates are any less resourceful than those brave people in Tahrir Square? They're not. So just as Hosni Mubarak could not stop freedom fighters, these laws will not stop pirates motivated by money. They can't. You cannot blacklist. I'm trying to remember who said it, but someone who's very involved in the early days of the internet said that the internet sees censorship as damage. And the internet was designed to root around damage. It's a military network by design. The whole point of the internet is that no single point of failure can bring it down. And censorship is indistinguishable from damage. And the internet roots around it. And you see that all over the world with these... If the Chinese government can't make blacklisting stick, and they are a totalitarian regime, what possible hope do the US government have of being any better at it without becoming even more totalitarian than the Chinese? Right. Or the Iranians, or all these other nations who try and fail at this.
It makes you wonder where they look to think that, hey, those guys did it right, let's do what they did.
It's if you don't understand the internet, then the idea of the Pirate Bay is a problem, we need a law that lets us say the Pirate Bay is illegal, is a solution. And at that level, that seems logical.
Right.
And if you watch C-SPAN, or if you follow a few news shows that give you the highlights of the debates on SOPA and PIPA that happen in the various committees throughout this process, and you watch the senators pushing this legislation try to explain themselves, you will understand that they haven't a bloody clue.
Hmm.
At one point, one of them actually said, you know, we should bring in the nerds to explain it to us.
Right, right, right. And that was the smartest thing I heard. Now, I was...
It sounded pretty dumb.
Sounded dumb? No, I think that's brilliant.
We should bring in the nerds?
Yeah, I think that bring in the nerds to explain it to us. That's wonderful if they're smart enough to know that they don't know. I mean, if you're trying to pass legislation on you know, how pipes work, you would bring in plumbers, wouldn't you?
You'd bring in experts, but you wouldn't describe it as bring in the nerds.
Well, I don't know. Nerd is not necessarily a derogatory term these days. I suppose they could have said geek and that would have been nicer. But
well, if you watch the way... If you watch the sort of the clip and the context of it...
It wasn't with respect, huh?
It was like the blind leading the blind grasping at straws. And eventually they sort of come to the conclusion that we should call the nerds.
Okay.
I mean, well, it was horrible to watch.
One of the things that I was hopeful about, and now I'm not hopeful at all, was that because of the giant protests and all of the companies that do create content and manage content pushing against these laws, getting everybody riled up and getting us all to, you know, call our congresspeople and get this thing stopped, that maybe they would step back and say, okay, it's pretty clear we don't understand what the effect of what we're doing is. So therefore, we need to step back and find a solution that actually takes the technology into account and let's work it. But instead, I was reading in the paper today that everyone in Hollywood is pissed off and they're angry about all this. Like Malcolm McDowell was quoted about how horrible all the piracy of his movie is and all this stuff. And their conclusion was that we didn't send the message correctly. There was no understanding that the law was bad. You know, it was that, you know, that it wouldn't work the way they thought it would work. And they were just that they just did bad marketing. That was their conclusion. It was just like, oh.
Yeah. And the other thing, I mean, that's a sign of just not getting it. But the other thing that I have seen that has made me made the hairs in the back of my neck stand up a bit is that the line trying to be pushed by the content industry is that if you're against SOPA, you're for piracy.
Mm.
And that's a straw man or a false dichotomy that should not be allowed to take root, because that is the greatest pile of bovine excrement that I've ever come across.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's right up there with the whole, oh, you're in favor of Social Security, so you're a communist. It's that sort of level of discourse, as in not.
Right, right.
Or, you know, you believe we should invade Iraq, therefore you're a totalitarian. No, that's just pathetic. You know, it's that level of, yeah, I hate it. So be wary of that one, because this isn't about being pro-pirate. This is about being anti-censorship, which is not the same thing in the slightest. The First Amendment isn't there to enable criminals. It has a much more important function. In fact, its function isn't to enable criminals.
It's to protect the innocent,
right? It's
not what
it's about. It's about protecting very important freedoms.
Well, and I mean, our laws are you know, innocent until proven guilty, and yet this sort of feels the opposite way. It's like you're guilty, and then maybe you can fight it after the fact if you're lucky. And
well, it's designed to go after people who are outside the U.S., so the logic being the U.S. Constitution should not be applied to these foreigners. They don't have rights. They're foreign. Which is why, as a non-American, I find this whole concept deeply insulting. Because the answer to, if you want to do something on a multinational level, on a multinational thing like the internet, what you need to do is you need to work with other nations to work together. How did they shut down Mega Upload? They shut down Mega Upload by working together with police in New Zealand, Hong Kong, the Netherlands, and a couple of other countries who I don't remember off the top of my head. It was a big nations coming together to fight a common problem thing.
Yeah, and that's sort of the success, right?
Yeah, and that's a great success. And the fact that that great success comes right after the defeat of Pippa and SOPA is kind of ironic, because it proves that there is no need for these laws.
No, of course, we're making the assumption that Mega Upload did something wrong, which has not yet been proven.
Okay, but for the purpose, okay, but if Mega
Upload, it was due process.
If Mega Upload did nothing wrong and they get let off, then the problem isn't that the laws weren't there to stop pirates. The problem is that Mega Upload aren't pirates, therefore there is no problem. Mm. Or Mega Upload are guilty, in which case the laws did work and mission accomplished.
Well, I think one of the problems with working with other countries, think specifically about China or Russia, is that they don't have laws that consider piracy wrong, at least in China. When they found those duplicate Apple stores, those fake Apple stores, a couple of them were shut down because they hadn't filed the right paperwork, but the other ones were left open because it was fully legal to do what they were doing. So their laws being that different makes it real hard to work with them.
Okay, but when you work with people to create international treaties, you're working about both sides changing their laws to become harmonious. So the way the European Union works is that it's that everyone agrees to pass laws in their country that will do X. So there is no such thing as a European law. There's a European directive which tells every country to implement the law that does X. So you have nations working together with their own legal systems who agree that we will all agree that it is illegal to do X.
Okay.
And so you need to work on international treaties to respect your copyright. But and there are a lot of international copyright treaties. They're just not fully global yet.
Okay.
So
I don't know if China is ever going to come on board with that, and they're an awfully dominant player in this situation, I think. So,
yeah, but then there's other ways of attacking it, because the money system is really quite global, and there's quite a lot of, you know, a lot of work to tackle crime is done by tackling the money, because that's what matters, right? The movie industry are not being killed by two friends sharing DVDs with each other.
Right.
That sort of casual quote-unquote piracy is not what's killing the music industry. It's people making massive fortunes by taking the work of others and selling it, and somehow profiting off it. So when you look at the list of cars seized in the Mega Upload, that gives you some idea of the amount of big money involved here. So when you want to attack the mob, what did they do? They went after the money. When you want to attack any sort of organized crime, you go after the money. And international treaties to clamp down on money. I mean, just look what happened after 9/11 with the laws all around the world to clamp down on assets belonging to terrorist organizations. They suddenly found they had no safe haven for their cash.
Yeah, but I don't know if you could say that problem has gone away, though.
No, but it's been very effectively attacked. It's much harder for Al-Qaeda to make and store money. They kind of have to keep it in the mattress now.
Okay.
You know, so, I mean, there were literally billions seized around the world. It was their money. It was in bank accounts in the UK and in Switzerland and all these places. And they just, yoink, not yours anymore. So going after the money is a much more effective way of dealing with these things And having extradition treaties and stuff is a much better way of dealing with these things. I actually think that the fact that they went after Mega Upload rather than after the, you know, random people who downloaded an episode of South Park was the first sign of some sense in this copyright war in a long time. Kind of ironic that it happened this week.
Well, there was some suggestion that it was on purpose when they did it, but because it was the day after the SOPA blackout.
I don't know. I mean, it's been 2 years in the working. I just cannot imagine all these police forces around the world colluding on the optics of U.S. politics.
Yeah, that's true.
Because when you're doing a sting operation, and it's very important that you arrest lots of people at the same time, you're much more worried about news getting out that, or anyone realizing that you're onto them than you are about anything else. I mean, I'm pretty confident that the police forces around the world, well, around the Western world anyway, are not politicized. Police forces are police forces, and they police.
Sure. So before we started, I was worried that maybe this was an irrelevant topic because SOPA and PIPA are dead, but you saw it differently.
Well, I do, because SOPA and PIPA are just names, and those names have been well and truly beaten into the ground. It is political suicide to be for those at the moment. And the chances are, with an election year in the US, the last chance of doing anything controversial was around about now. Because the primaries are kicking in January, you know, we're all in the full swing of trying to pick who it is the Republicans are going to pick to go up against President Obama. And then the presidential election is going to kick in, and then you're going to have the Republican versus Democrat. And everyone's going to be very keen to do only popular things. So there's going to be no danger of anything too unpopular happening between now and this time next year. But this time next year, you'll have a Congress who won't be up for election for 2 more years, a president who won't be up for election for 4 more years, and a bunch of new senators with 6 years on the clock. That's the point when governments do unpopular things, when they have the most possible time until the next election.
So a year and a half from now, we should become more vigilant and pay attention?
I think starting next year is a time to be vigilant, because the motivations for doing this have not gone away. The big moneyed interests still have that interest. They are now thinking how they can spin this better. They're not thinking, okay, we've lost this war. They're thinking, okay, we got to lay low so everyone forgets about us, come up with a whole new acronym, a whole new set of bills. We'll do it all from scratch, but the intent is going to be the same, to censor the internet, because that is how they think they can protect their business model, by censoring the internet. So I think this is going to be a long-term battle, probably years, until it becomes obvious to everyone that a free and open internet is in everyone's best interests. And the more Leo Laportes there are in this world, and the fewer Viacoms, the easier that argument is to make.
So. Right.
I mean, I don't know. 10 years from now, I just think if we make it to 10 years from now without something horrible happening, or the other thing that could happen is we do this, it crushes innovation. Everyone suddenly goes, whoa, that was a bad idea, but I'd rather not learn the lesson that way.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. All right. Well, I think I understand it better. At least I think I understand the repercussions, and I was hoping we would just go, da-na-na-na-na-na-na-na, yay, it's over, the big bad witch is dead.
No. In the real world, unfortunately, things never go like that.
You sure? I can't be happy. We could be a little happy.
Oh, absolutely. You know, battle won, great. War not over.
Okay. All right. Battle won, great. War not over. That's a good place to end, I think, Bart.
Okie dokie. Until next week, then. Happy computing.
Well, that's going to wind us up for this week. Many thanks to our sponsors for helping to pay the bills. Really do go to their sites. It really makes a difference. Our two big sponsors are ScreenSteps and Smile. Don't forget to send in your dumb questions, comments, and suggestions by emailing me at allison@podfeet.com. Follow me on Twitter @podfeet. I contribute a lot over on Google+, so go on over and circle me up there, too. If you want to join in the live show fun, head on over to podfeet.com/live on Sunday nights at 5 p.m. Pacific time and join the friendly and enthusiastic Nocilla Castaways. Thanks for listening, and stay subscribed.